Nancy McLean is an award-winning author, historian, and the William Schaff Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. The name of her new book is Democracy in Chains: The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It is an expose of the man and the ideas behind the billionaire-funded right's campaign to eliminate unions, suppress voting, privatize public education, change the Constitution, and curb Democratic majority rule. James McGill Buchanan is not a household name, but McLean has uncovered his role in designing the approach in which the Koch brothers, among others, would eventually invest massively with the aim of permanently disabling the democratic process in favor of free-reign capitalism. Again, the name of the book is Democracy in Chains, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Nancy McLean to the roundtable this morning. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
What brought you to the subject, and particularly the look at this one particular gentleman?
I actually had not set out to research the backstory of the ideas that are informing this push to transform our government led by the Koch donor network. But I had started actually with a story of the 1950s in Virginia when the state government was leading something called massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education decisions. And in the course of researching that, I came across an economist who had been trained at the University of Chicago and who had just arrived at the University of Virginia in 1956, who started arguing for, not in racial terms, but in economic terms, for one of the most extreme measures advocated by the massive resistors, which was privatization of the public education system to send tax revenues to private schools that would be beyond the reach of the federal courts. And that just really took me aback. And this man's name was James McGill Buchanan. And then I learned that he had won a Nobel Prize in 1986 for his thinking about government and about constitutional matters. And I became very intrigued. And at some point, the project changed, and I began following him instead. And lo and behold, I then discovered that his ideas were informing the strategy being used by the Koch donor network and this kind of radical right libertarian push to transform our country.
James McGill Buchanan was born in 1919, passed away in 2013. When do we in history start to hear this man's name and see some impact being made?
Well, many people who trained in economics, if you have listeners who are economists or even political scientists or legal scholars, they may well have learned about him in their graduate study. I know many others did, particularly if they trained after he won the Nobel Prize in 1986. But in practical terms, his ideas began to have an impact in the Reagan era. He had a few of his PhD students who went into the Reagan administration. And then in the 1990s with the Republican Revolution in Congress, you know, many of us remember Newt Gingrich as the face of that, but the real thinker and strategist behind it was Dick Armey, who was himself an economist who was a real enthusiast of Buchanan's style of economics, which is called public choice. So Armey was a big player in that in bringing it into Washington and beginning the transformation of the Republican Party. And then the real turning point, though, the very significant turning point came in 1997 when Charles Koch invested the first $10 million in Buchanan's center at George Mason University and then made that university a part of it, what ultimately became called the Mercatus Center, made that into a kind of academic base camp and training institute for his, you know, the literally hundreds of ostensibly separate but actually connected organizations that are now funded by Koch network donors and others. And when Koch invested there in 1997, he said in a speech to the people who were assembled there that he wanted to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus. And another time he compared himself to Martin Luther in this. So Koch really had a sense that what he was doing with Buchanan's ideas was really going to transform the course of American history, and he hopes world history. It's a very messianic vision, and it has quite frightening implications for most of us on matters from Social Security to public education to the quality of our air and water. So we could talk more about that if you would like, but it was quite stunning to me as a researcher to find all this.
Did Buchanan see what he was doing as a movement?
It's interesting. I went to Buchanan's memorial conference held in his honor, memorial conference at George Mason to try to get a sense of what his colleagues said about him. You know, I was also going then to get into the archives, his personal archives. But one of the speakers there, who's part of this operation that Koch helped create and for a long time has served on the board of directors of at Mercatus, one of the speakers said that Buchanan had always understood that they needed a movement. And so I thought that was very interesting. And yeah, from his very first center in Virginia in 1956, Buchanan was clearly interested in training a new generation or generations of thinkers who would lead this effort to change society. And then in the early 1970s, he set out very self-consciously to begin creating what he called a counterintelligentsia. So he was doing that in the 70s, but it's really, again, in the late 1990s, after Koch decides these are the ideas he's been looking for decades, and he, by his own admission, he had been funding hundreds of intellectuals seeking the right set of ideas that could get him what he wanted. And as Koch invested in George Mason and in using these ideas as a kind of strategy and blueprint to get him what he wanted, they then begin to really start to train talent and groom, you know, what has become hundreds of people to go out and staff various wings of the operation. Now they very much call themselves a movement. They call themselves the Liberty Movement or sometimes the Freedom Movement. But I think, you know, if you look into the ideas, you'll find that it has nothing to do with freedom for the rest of us. It's about freedom for people of great wealth and property in a way that will have dire consequences, quite frankly, for the vast majority. And that's why they're operating by stealth.
You used the term what they wanted. If you were to ask Buchanan of a mission statement, that mission statement would say what?
Oh, good question. So, so Buchanan and these libertarians like Koch and others in this network believe that the only appropriate roles of government are essentially three, to enforce the rule of law, to provide for the national defense, and to ensure social order. So all the kinds of things that citizens have looked to government for, to the federal government in particular, since at least the 1890s with the populist movement, the progressive era, the New Deal, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, you know, environmental activism, you can go through the list. They see all those things as being illegitimate, and they don't want them. And they think government should not be doing this, and that it's an interference with the liberty of particularly property owners. It's a very kind of property supremacist cause is the way that I've come to think about it. And they want to prevent that. And what was new with Buchanan is, like, these are things that libertarians in the United States had long thought, but they were quite marginal for a very long time. What happens with Buchanan's thought is that they get, again, an operational strategy to act on those ideas. So what Buchanan brought that was new was his own understanding of how government grew over time, over the course of the 20th century. And he understood that it began with social movements. It began with ordinary people who could not achieve the changes that they felt that they needed or that they wanted on their own. So they came together with other people, you know, again, whether it was farmers in the 1890s or workers in the 1930s or African Americans in the 1950s, et cetera, all of those groups could not achieve change as individuals through the political system or as individuals in the market. And so they came together and built power and made claims on government. And most of us see that as having produced some of the things we're most proud of in American history, you know, some of the achievements and reforms and such that made life, you know, more fair for all, that cleaned up our air and water, that did all these things. But to these guys, these things are illegitimate. So Buchanan's idea was first of all, to inform strategy for how to break up the power of those groups, particularly labor unions, but also any other kind of collective groups, how to change the rules of government so as to prevent those groups from being able to amass power again. And he always talked about how we have to change not just we should focus not on who rules, but on the rules. So very sophisticated strategies for how to change the rules of government. And we've seen that applied in a breakneck way over the last few years, particularly since 2011. So breaking down the power of groups, changing all the rules of government and of public policy in ways that will debilitate groups and enhance the power of property holders. And then the ultimate thing is a constitutional strategy. And Buchanan's biggest push by the late 1970s on was for what he called constitutional revolution. And he believed that no constitution in the world provided adequate protection for the wealthy and for property holders. So he had ideas about how to design a constitution that would do that. And he did that in particular. He tried it out in Chile in 1980 when the Pinochet dictatorship wanted to prepare for what they knew they had to do ultimately, which was transition back to a system of elections. But they wanted to keep the massive changes that they had made in the society and its politics in place. And so Buchanan went to Chile and advised them on the kinds of minute rules that would go into a constitution to make that happen. And it essentially put locks and bolts on what the Chilean people could do. And so then they brought that model back to America. And now your listeners should know that the effort to change the U.S. Constitution has proceeded through 28 states. There's only six more needed to call a constitutional convention that could make these radical changes in our Constitution. And the Koch Network is pushing very hard for it in their state policy network. So it's something that I think every citizen needs to know about and be informed of.
So as you write in the book about these components of our democracy, the Buchanan was looking to eliminate the social movement, if you will, the catalyst for all of this, of course, is money. At what point did he realize the power of money and what it could do in accomplishing these goals?
So interesting that you raise that, because he spoke quite clearly about that, and sometimes actually quite crudely. He talked about the need to create a gravy train on the right and a system of incentives that would pull people to their side. And he actually said at one point in one of his key movement building documents, money talks. So they were quite strategic in using money to build a movement. And in fact, his first center was created. He created it with the support of the University of Virginia administration in 1956. With monies that were coming from an anti-New Deal foundation that was funding a lot of these radical right projects at the time and paying the salaries of libertarian economists such as Friedrich Hayek, if your listeners have ever heard of him, or Ludwig von Mises. They were supporting Milton Friedman as he wrote Capitalism and Freedom. So they very clearly understood that subsidies from these right-wing wealthy people and corporations could help to get them what they want. And I guess I think it's important, too. I don't want to just say that it's the wealthy or the rich, because always these efforts have been from a minority, a particular really ideologically driven right-wing minority of the wealthy and of corporations. And, you know, my dad was a company a senior vice president and a lifelong Republican voter, and he's no longer alive. But I think he would be shocked and appalled at what's happening here. So I don't mean to make this sound like it's all business or it's all Republican voters, because it's absolutely not. It's this minority subset that has figured out a very sophisticated strategy in order to get what it wants, and it's essentially commandeered the Republican Party through the use of large campaign contributions to be used as a weapon. It's commandeered the Republican Party as a delivery vehicle for what is not the agenda of most Republican voters, but again, of these radical right, extremely wealthy donors.
The Freedom Caucus pretty much killed the first round of the health bill,
right,
and had great reservations, and for many on the left, were actually cheering on the Freedom Caucus to kill this bill. But now we look at a situation that we're in where this bill is marching forward in great secrecy, in great silence, and quite frankly, without much information to even those who are involved in the process. So it is that part of it as well, to move things forward, which is basically saying, okay, we know what's better for you than you do, and we're going to go ahead and you'll thank us later.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're raising this issue of operating in the dark, because I've watched this up close in North Carolina, where, you know, the kind of state version of the Freedom Caucus took over in 2011 and has been operating this way with, you know, just violating all standard norms of procedure. You know, no hearings, 2 minutes of debate on, you know, hugely important bills, no witnesses, sometimes crucial stuff passed after midnight. I mean, it's just astonishing how they're operating. And that way of operating has now, as you point out, gone federal on the healthcare issue. And I think the most important thing I could point out here to help your listeners understand what's happening is to say that this is a self-consciously minority movement. And I have, you know, Charles Koch saying it in his own words, that he said, basically, because we're a permanent minority, because we can never get a majority to agree with their agenda, if they state it openly, they have to work in this manner that you're describing. So it's a horrible thing to me as a historian. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in the history of our country. I mean, it's really, really, really a departure. But the thing that is important to know about it, or to hold in mind, I think, so that people don't panic but do start to pay attention and do start to make their voices heard, is that this is a minority agenda. You know, if you look at the new version of the healthcare bill, I believe I read the other day that it has only 14% support. You know, and again, most Republicans do not support what the Republicans in Congress are pushing, whether it's on the healthcare issue, whether it's on taxation, whether it's on environmental issues, Social Security and Medicare. On all of these things, the Republican Party is grossly out of step with its own voters, and it is doing the bidding of donors. And the way the donors are operating comes from this James Buchanan, who understood that the crucial thing to do was to change the rules and change the incentives. So what they've done in particular to get compliance from the Republicans in Congress is to run these really costly primary challenges to them, so that we have this new verb called, you know, to be primaried. So that even long-term Republicans who were known for being principled, whether or not one agreed with them on things, you know, like John McCain and Orrin Hatch, even people like them were primaried, and after being primaried are now towing the line. And so it's just a really frightening thing to behold, but I think if people understand the strategy in play, they will be better equipped to kind of break the code on what's happening and be able to take effective action.
So let me ask a question that in my head is somewhat unwieldy. So let me try to rein it in and have it make some semblance of sense. That is that when you look at where we are right now, where Republicans, and again, using the health bill as an example, it seems as though for many Republicans and many of those on the far right, of what is the goal and what is on the table is much more important and is the driving force to what they're doing, while this sideshow, which is the Trump administration and what is happening there, seems to be of little concern, where they could come and say, oh, this is very concerning to us of what is happening, the Russian investigation, we have a foreign power interfering in our government, interfering in our elections, we should take concern over this. But instead, it seems that these issues have more importance to them, the power that they have of leading the House, leading the Senate, having a presence on the Supreme Court, and of course having a Republican president, that those things are more important than these grave concerns that are happening day to day within the White House.
I could not agree with you more. I think that the Trump himself is a giant distraction. I mean, I almost think it's like a classic con where he, you know, does these outrageous things and he gets our attention and we all focus on his tweets while they move through this radical transformational agenda at every level, including in all the agencies and the rules changes that have gone on so far, you know, forgetting, you know, all that's before Congress. And I think part of our trouble in understanding this is that the media, not knowing the backstory of, you know, these Buchananite ideas, the public choice ideas that the Koch network is using, has assumed that the Trump story and the Koch story are two different stories, that somehow the Koch story was last year's story, and now we must all focus on Trump and his latest tweets and the Russia investigation. And I, you know, again, I can't say anything on this definitively because, you know, we don't have access to those archives yet. The journalists need to do the work. But I will say there are a number of things that suggest that the lines between the Koch operation and the Trump team are quite porous. So just a few examples. Vice President Mike Pence comes out of these Koch operations. You know, he's been very involved in several of them, in the Indiana versions and in the national versions. Mark Short, who is the White House Director of Legislative Affairs, spent 5 years at Freedom Partners, the big Koch donor network operation, and yet now he's guiding legislative strategy in Congress. Scott Pruitt, Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, all of these key people in the Trump administration, not all, but many of them come from the Koch network and are deeply, you know, immersed in it, have those ideas, are applying that agenda. And now, did Trump knowingly hire these people? You know, is he part of something? I kind of doubt it because his attention span is so limited. But he, you know, I don't think he really expected to win. And once he did win, he didn't have any team. He didn't have, you know, any people. He wasn't connected to the old kind of wing of the party. And these, you know, people stepped into the breach, and now they're effectively running the show. And so I am really trying to urge anybody, you know, I talk to stop following those tweets, to stop, you know, paying attention to the intrigue and look at the agenda that's being moved at Washington, pay attention to what the Freedom Caucus is doing, pay attention to what Freedom Partners are doing, pay attention to what Americans for Prosperity in your state is pushing for, the Club for Growth, what they're saying. These are the true sources of power at this moment. And I think if we start paying attention to them, we'll get a much better understanding of what's going on.
The biggest lesson that came out of this book for me in reading it, as if, you know, I didn't already have my worries and suspicions. However, the biggest thing that comes out of this book is that democracy is not something that you can just assume will survive.
Absolutely. Thank you. That is the single most important lesson from this book. And there, you know, there are other, I mean, I do believe that we are at an absolutely critical moment in our history, a moment that will determine the nature of our society and our government for the next few generations. The people on this Koch team have made very clear that they think that these are going to be permanent changes. If they can get them through, everything will be different thereafter. So, you know, I know people have 1,000 demands on them and everybody is overwhelmed and anxious and there's so much news coming at us, it's hard to pay attention. But my most important message to readers is we won't get this chance again. You know, pay attention to what's happening here. Understand what's going on. Don't be distracted and start talking to your neighbors, working with organizations you trust, working, you know, with people you believe in, and contacting your representatives and make sure that we correct course, because I don't think 80%+ of us would want the future that these people have in mind for us.
And when you say the future, I think that's another key point that comes out of the book is that it's so often that we just round this up and say, well, it's all about money. They're just trying to get money. It basically goes down to greed. Well, if that were the simple explanation, and it's one explanation, but it's it seems, at least in reading this book and looking at Buchanan and the ideals that are being grasped here, it's far more evil than that.
Well, you know, evil is in the perspective of the beholder, right? So I find it absolutely frightening, and I can tell you, quite frankly, that there were times when I was doing this research when I felt physically nauseated, and I felt very afraid. And so I totally understand people having that reaction, but I also agree with you that, you know, we've had some brilliant and really talented and determined investigative journalists working on this issue of these, you know, this dark money and what it's doing in our politics. But because they don't have the deep history and the backstory, there's a tendency to think that this is just about partisanship or that it's just about, you know, venality, about people being, as you say, greedy and wanting more for themselves. But I do not think that we can understand this unless we realize how deeply ideological it is, that the people, you know, who are pushing this agenda have a very strong morality of their own. I find it frightening. I find it cruel and appalling, and it's unlike any religious tradition that I know or all the good people that I know. You know, it's not about anyway, you know, so, but they do have their own values, and those values are shared by the rank and file that they're counting on, the rank and file kind of right-wing base of the Republican Party who is helping move this along. And so unless somebody actually finds a way to speak to those rank and file voters to let them know that they too are targets, we're not going to get anywhere. And when I say they too are targets, here's what I'm getting at. Some of our best social scientists, including Theda Scotchpole at the Kennedy School of Government, she and a student, Vanessa Williams, wrote a fabulous book on the Tea Party where they went out and they tried to meet every single Tea Party person that they could. They went to meetings, they observed, and they could not find a single rank-and-file member of the Tea Party who wanted to see Social Security privatization or Medicare privatization. But that is exactly what the Koch network is using their rank-and-file energies to do, to move that agenda. And so they're deceiving their own base. And I want to be able to let people know that, you know, so that if they want to keep working for this operation in the full knowledge of what it really stands for, that's fine, and that's their choice. But I think all of us have a right to know what this is really about and what it's really going to do to our society. And in the book, I use the words of some people who are key players in this cause who tell us what society is going to look like, and it is frightening. Well, one of them, Tyler Cohen, who's at George Mason University, who's a co-director of the Mercatus Center and who has one of the most popular economics blogs there is. Tyler Cohen tells us that Texas is the future for many of us in America. He tells us that we'll have favelas, you know, Rio de Janeiro style favelas in our cities, that we may not have decent water, the kind of water that we're expected, you know, that we've come to expect. And then he says, get ready, you know. And so I want Americans to know what this cause is actually about, behind all the nice phrases about freedom and liberty and, you know, the bogus appeals to you know, the Constitution's framers. I want people to know that their true guiding star is John C. Calhoun, you know, who was departed from James Madison, whose ideas appalled James Madison and who brought the country to the brink of civil war. Americans need to know where these ideas come from, what they're about, and what they will do to all of us, and you know, while we still have time to stop it.
The name of the book is Democracy in Chains: The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Nancy, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate your great work.
Thank you so much, Joe, and thank you for your excellent questions.
Very nice to have you on the program. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Again, the name of the book is Democracy in Chains: The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. It is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.